All right, so far we have looked at the character issue and the heart of and foundation of all leadership, and we've begun to look at the dangers. We've covered some of the wrong motivations that lead us into ministry problems, and then we, of course, just finished looking at how we can lead our church into the balance of the use of gifts and not have bitternesses and jealousies and strife over giftedness. It is the leader's responsibility to lead the church in those proper perspectives, and so it's good to cover those things. What I want to do now is head on into part two of the dangers of pastoral leadership and talk about the issue of conflict, not only resolving conflict between leaders, but also teaching the church how to solve problems in ministry in a way that honors Christ. We have a task in front of us, and it isn't to create unity in the church, but to preserve it. The body of Christ is brought together by the Spirit of God, and so the unity is there in the Spirit. The problem is we are a hindrance to it when we're not mature. And so the bottom line here is that it is our role and privilege to preserve the unity that has been given to us by the Spirit of God. Paul says to the Corinthian church, of course, a great example to us because of the conflict that riddled this congregation. But he says in chapter 1 and verse 10, "I am exhorting you, brethren, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you all agree and that there be no divisions among you, but that you be made complete in the same mind and in the same judgment." Notice here, he's not discussing clearly the differences that are normal and natural between leaders, or even differences, strong differences of opinion. We know that because in verse 10, he says that you be made complete in the same mind and in the same judgment. Again, we have to be made complete by the renewing of our minds as we are sanctified. So here we know he's talking about unity around what the Spirit of God teaches us. So clearly it's unity around the truth. Sometimes there is confusion over this issue. I remember a pastor saying one time when asked in a question and answer session, how do you create unity in the church or preserve unity in the church? And he said, find all the people that disagree with you and get rid of them. Just get rid of them. And of course, you know, everyone chuckled as we ought, because it's in one sense, if we looked at it the wrong way, it would be quite a humorous statement. On the other hand, it can be taken seriously in the sense that Paul means it here. What Paul means to say here is that we ought to have the same mind created by the Spirit of God in us, by the renewing process. So the unity we're talking about that we preserve is spiritual driven unity. It is the unity around the truth that is at stake. And the leadership of the church must preserve it and make distinctions between differences that are normal and natural as the various personalities come together in the church to lead it, and distinguish that from doctrinal error or differences that have to do with the essentials of the faith. So what Paul is saying here to the Corinthian church is, I want you to all agree essentially around the truth, or the unity driven by the Spirit in the renewing of your mind with the truth. That would be the implication. And that there be no divisions among you, no personal differences that are disrupting the truth, and no confusion over the essentials of the faith, where you have one person teaching one thing and someone counteracting that and teaching another. I don't want that to be, so that you may be made complete. The implication is, by the Spirit you're made complete in the same mind and in the same judgment. It also tells us then that that's possible. That's a reachable goal. We can't be cynical simply because there is a lot of division over other things. And maybe you've been embattled in your leadership team and leadership dynamics for so long that you just think this is pie in the sky and utterly impossible. But Paul says, this is what I'm exhorting you to do. So we're commanded to preserve this unity by doing these things in order that no division exists in the church. So the leadership is where it begins. There should be a doctrinally united front, as the body is maturing. So therefore, on a micro level, the leadership, as it matures, should have a united doctrinal front and make clear distinctions between the essentials of the faith and all of the different personality difficulties we have and personal struggles over preferences. We should be able to clearly work toward unity in what is essential. And, of course, the goal is to exalt Jesus Christ in the body and not become a personal preference ministry stroking our own interests. The problem in the life of the church, I think the greatest problem in the life of the church, is that Satan gets an inroad in the church. And yes, he could do it with the vulnerable sheep under the care of the leaders. But if he can create division over sinful tendencies and sinful behavior in the leadership, then the sheep will be scattered. So, yes, he is scheming against the sheep, but the greater scheme is against the leadership. When Paul was speaking to the Ephesian elders in Acts 20, there near the harbor, he says to them in that text that he is confident of something. And this is, you know, an important reminder to us that when you are not able to lead the church, or if there's going to be a time of vulnerability, it will come when you are not in a position to shepherd the flock. If the sheep had no shepherd, here's what Paul knows is going to happen. In Acts 20, he says, "I know that when I leave," I know this is going to happen to you. "Be on your guard," verse 28. "For all the flock of God." Verse 29, "I know that after my departure, savage wolves are coming in. And they're not going to spare the flock. They're going to shred it. And from among your own selves," oh, that must have killed. I remember when I preached this passage to our church and I pointed my finger out at the flock and I said, "Some of you may be used by Satan to divide the flock." And some lady, sweet little old lady, came up to me afterwards and said, "I couldn't believe you said that to us. We love the church." And I said, "Look, I'm just telling you what Paul says. I know that from among your own selves." Now, he was talking to elders, so I'm sure they got the point that Satan's going to attack the leadership primarily. "From among your own selves, men will arise, speaking perverse things to draw away the disciples after them." They have a goal, they have the means, they are in and among yourselves, so they have the position, they have it all. And he says, "I know it's going to happen." So if you're going to be in a position of leadership and the leadership dynamic in your church is beginning to gel and you're serving in the church, you're going to have to guard against the hazards of ministry. And the ministry is vulnerable. And that's what Paul is describing here. It's a vulnerable ministry. It's vulnerable at the leadership level because Satan is coming. And so as leaders, we do not want to shred the sheep simply because we have been naive or ignorant or neglectful or cavalier. Verse 31, "Therefore be on the alert." Be on the alert. Here's how Paul preserved the unity. "Night and day, for a period of 3 years, I didn't cease to admonish each one with tears." I mean, that is investment right there. That is investment. He was in the elders' homes. Not only was he in the homes of people in the church as they taught, and if you know anything about the early church when it first gathered, they catechized the children and the families in the homes with the doctrine. So while they met on the Lord's Day, on Sunday, all through the week, they had homes where there were meetings going on and further catechizing as the doctrine was being orally distributed until the letters were finally completed. And so Paul was in on that as a shepherd, and particularly with the elders. And so he says, "You remember, here's how I was preserving the unity, night and day, 3 years, I didn't cease to admonish each one," and there was passion and pathos in it. Sometimes I was so broken over the concern of wolves coming in that I was tearful. That's how I preserve the unity. I was concerned about divisiveness at the leadership level. You know, sometimes it amazes me how cavalier elders can be about this issue. You know, we're afraid sometimes of conflict in general, largely because we experience sometimes so little of it. And when it starts to happen, we think conflict itself ought to just go away. And so what happens is we start to love peace. And if conflict comes up at all, we're not even ready to fight for the truth. We have no stomach for it anymore. One of the ways Satan harms the unity of the church is just to create a group of guys who are cavalier about the dangers. And assemble a group of happy-go-luckies. Man, they're leading the church. Everything's good. Oh, there's some conflict? No, don't be bringing up any of that. We're a happy church. Where conflict is bad. All conflict is bad. What if you're fighting for the truth? All conflict can't be bad because Paul says, be on the alert. Here's how you are to preserve the unity. You make sure you know this. That some are coming in and they're going to try to destroy the truth and get an inroad to the leadership and create division in the heart and soul of the shepherds of the church. They're going to speak perverse things. How are you going to refute that if you're afraid of the conflict itself? Sometimes conflict is about truth. And when it's about truth, our only response is night and day, 3 years, whatever it takes. Admonishing every leader, letting that leader go and admonish the flock that's committed to their care, and even with passion and sometimes with choked up brokenness over the concern. And then he says, I commend you to God and to the word of his grace. I love that. That is one of my favorite lines in this passage. I commend you to God. Look, God's going to have to help us with this. He's going to have to, behind the scenes, keep us from our own selves. Protect us from our own pettiness. And I commend you to the word of his grace. Right in the middle of the preservation of unity and the protection against division and false teachers is this commitment to the word of God, which is able to build you up and give you the inheritance among all those who are sanctified. So the word makes us holy. The word guarantees a mature coming on into our glorious inheritance with maturity. It builds us up. It protects us and preserves unity. So, Paul says, it's a vulnerable ministry. You better be on the alert. You need to watch out for yourself. This is a serious matter. But at the same time, conflict is difficult. Conflict is extremely challenging. Because nobody wants to spoil for it. In fact, the guys that do spoil for a fight, I don't really like to spend much time around a leader that spoils for a fight. I don't much care for the guy in the room that is just waiting for someone to knock the chip off his shoulder so he can fight about something. We don't want to spoil for conflict or a fight over something, but we can't be those who run from it. And so in order for us to fight for the truth but keep from pettiness, we've got to think this issue through. We've got to think the issue of conflict through and think it through wisely. This is no call to compromise the truth. We will battle for the truth, but if we can't make those distinctions, then we're going to become petty and not know the difference, and there will be division at the leadership level which ravages the church. And a leadership team that is godly in its application of the principles toward the resolution of conflict will bless the sheep and cultivate an environment, as Dr. Wayne Mack says, where conflict, sinful conflict, dies a natural death. So that's what we want to talk about. How do we bring unity to a divided leadership? How do we preserve that unity? How do the unity of the Spirit? How do we take care of understanding these distinctions and maturing in them and then pass that on to the flock? Well, first of all, it's important to understand that differences on a leadership team are common, they're natural, they're God-given, and they're not always easy. The fact that we have differences is important because it demonstrates the beauty of the variety of the body of Christ. When you lead people in ministry, diversity of perspective is a growth instrument. It's an instrument for our growth. So we have to make a distinction between differences of opinion, even strong differences of opinion, and a conflict that has descended into sinfulness. We have to make a distinction. You do not want to have a leadership team of people who have no ability to flourish in the way that God's made them simply because they're intimidated into being yes men. You can't have a leadership team like that that is going to be effective. It is true that we're going to disagree on things. We're going to disagree sometimes on how best to manage information at the leadership level and how much is told to the church. We're going to differ sometimes on where we set our priorities and how we spend our resources in the ministry. Those differences are a normal part of the body of Christ, but sometimes they end up in bitter loggerheads simply because men aren't making good distinctions. There are common causes of division, and I would, in making the distinction between sinful division and just differences of opinion, we'll sort of make that distinction all the way throughout. There are some common causes of just normal disagreement, even strong disagreement, that really at times have nothing to do with sin. And first of all, when you become a leader in the church, you're going to come into the midst of other men leading the church that you're not exactly like. You have a different personality. And I would say that personality we could just sort of capsulize as the subject of life habits and how you interact with people through those life habits. I mean, all of us have a personality, but defining it's a little bit challenging without getting a little psychoanalytical. And that's unnecessary. God, in His Word, doesn't really talk so much about different personalities. We just acknowledge naturally that we are made different. We're a different person. So we have a different disposition, different attitudes, different way we respond to life. And it involves how we respond to our physiological factors and how that mixes in with the immaterial part of us, the soul of man, our affections, desires, emotions, thoughts, reasonings. We're wired a certain way. Describing that down to the detail is well nigh impossible. But suffice it to say, for our purposes, we're different. And to expect to come onto a leadership team and expect other men to just sort of go along with everything we say without comment, as if they look at life the same way, it's just impossible. Interpersonal friction sometimes arises from just the strong disposition that we carry through life and the strong difference between them. You know, you can take all the personality tests you want. I think some of those are borderline on assumptive, if not totally assumptive at times. Other times they're just trying to describe different categories of how people act. And have you ever looked at a Taylor Johnson test or any of those personality tests? Insofar as they are helpful, I don't know, because I don't know if people answer the questions honestly. You know, you might be a personality who likes to hide information about yourself. So what good is taking the test? Because the results are going to be flawed and subjective. So given the amount of subjectivity in such tests, I think the best thing we can say is that all they reveal is the way that people look at life differently when they answer questions. And that proves that we're going to deal with ministry responsibilities, looking at them through a different grid at times, sometimes very strong. Now, I don't think when two personalities clash on a leadership team that that means that they should never serve together. I don't think that's the case, because I think all of us need to grow. And if you eliminated all of the most abrasive counter personalities to yours, you're going to be learning to coddle your own self. And I don't think that's good. Now, you don't want to throw two of the most different personalities in one room and say, live there forever without help, because one is going to emerge alive and the other dead, probably. or both strangling each other. But nonetheless, we're called to adjust. We're called to change. None of us have a right to sit around the table and say, well, that's the way I'm wired. You just live with it. It may be the way you're wired, but you still have to be sanctified. And the way you're wired is still affected by fallenness. And so you have to make the assumption, you know what, that may be the way I'm wired, but it doesn't mean I can't be sanctified and have that area affected. Can't cease to be you, but God never intended for you to be, you know, staying in your sinfulness if he indeed saved you to sanctify you. The goal is to take your personality and the way you're wired and conform it to the image of Jesus Christ in all that the Bible says. But at the same time, recognizing that we have different people skills and different personalities is important. When they clash, it's not an alarm bell that says we're dying as a leadership team. It's just normal. Sometimes those clashes are really strong. Furthermore, we have different perspectives because of how we have grown up and interacted with life through our years of experience. I mean, your background alone makes you exceedingly different as a leader in a room with other leaders. Family traditions, the way that you grew up in your family, the way you handled economics, the way you look at history and the history of your family and upbringing, the status that you grew up experiencing, the family structure of your life, the style of life that you lived. Sometimes differences on a leadership team just boil down to completely and utterly unfamiliar backgrounds between two people that are clashing. It's okay. It's normal. It's a part of it. My closest comrade on my staff and my elder board, it couldn't be opposite from me in family backgrounds. I am from the beaches of Southern California. I grew up in a big city like Los Angeles. He was born in West Virginia, in the deep south of the United States. Very conservative culture, backwoods country. He loves to listen to country music. I rarely, if ever, listen to country music. He is a NASCAR racing fanatic. I find it boring, unless I'm in the cockpit, driving it. He likes to watch it. Not an interest to me. There are a few likes that are the same and dislikes that are the same, but we couldn't be different. Our family structures are different. His family's relatively quiet. Mine is relatively active and busy and talkative. Small wonder. And so we come together in ministry and, man, our perspectives at times on an issue in ministry couldn't be different. His family spent money different than our family. His structure was different. Holidays were spent different. The status of life was different. And when we come to a ministry decision, man, it is a challenge sometimes just to recognize, wow, we have a different grid through which we look at X situation. And then sometimes our goals are different. We have different purposes. He's trying to reach a different goal than I am. Sometimes a leader is just committed to different goals than you are. If you were to list out your goals in life and ministry and for the church, and they were to list theirs out, apart from biblical principles, just preferences, man, this would be your set of preferences, that would be theirs, and they could be poles apart. And sometimes that's generating the irritation in general when you both come to an issue in ministry. That's normal. Don't be afraid of that. It's good for you. Difficult? Yeah. Sometimes irritating? Yeah. But that's really just God using that to get us crucified to the flesh and helping us learn from one another. Sometimes our pursuits are different. What is that? Our manner of reaching those goals. You put in place a way to live, to reach your goals, and to serve in the church, and your particular comforts and way of doing things are involved in that, the way your mind works, and somebody else's manner of reaching their goals, their pursuits and habits are completely the opposite. I grew up And am wired more for abstract thinking and artistic things. I was a musician. I was an English major. Communication side of things. When I get on an elder board with an engineer type, we clash. They like things and pursue their goals in life with very systematic parameters that have very measurable and reachable points. And in the end, it's very satisfying to see everything come together in nice, neat boxes and packages. I'm completely comfortable with a fly-by-wire moment. I'm completely comfortable with that. I don't mind abstracts. I don't mind intangibles. Some of the guys on our board don't like that. They're not comfortable with that. So when a problem presents itself, we go about solving it in a different manner. That's normal. I can learn from that. He can learn from me. Together, God brings that together for His greater purposes. And in the beauty of that diversity, we learn to preserve unity in the Spirit together by getting outside of ourselves. Sometimes there's even a different power. On the elder board, there's different levels of maturity, different levels of sanctification going on, and it creates tension, struggle, friction. Perhaps some of you have men on your leadership who aren't saved. They just don't know it yet, and neither do you. And they operate on a different power, different ethic. They're a natural man who thinks that they are a spiritual man. These are normal differences that God uses to shape our leadership as we pursue the preservation of unity. And you should rejoice in the diversity, explore it, learn from it, help the leadership team to be comfortable with it and not be afraid of it, and keep yourself from personal offensiveness and from being personally offended over these things. That is the difficulty right there. Because none of us likes to enjoy working in the church while next to us is someone who completely irritates us. You know who those people are who irritate you. And you try to avoid them. And as a leader in the church, you have to shepherd people that irritate you, but as a leader in the church, you have to minister alongside others who see ministry different than you, and in your mind, they're just an irritant. Paul and Barnabas experienced this, did they not? Do you remember? You remember what happened in Acts chapter 15, where they came together to go on their missionary journey, and in Acts 15, they came to the decision about who would go along, and Barnabas was excited about taking John Mark. If you know anything about the first missionary journey, John Mark lacked courage. He was selfish, faint-hearted, or unruly, or whatever. He failed in the work, and you know what? Paul and Barnabas viewed it differently. Barnabas came away imagining that what John Mark needed was a little more close discipleship. Paul came away saying that was a waste of the resources of God's people and a waste of our time, and maybe he's just not suited for that, so let's leave him home. And so you had two different perspectives. Whether or not they sinned in the sharp disagreement is not germane to this discussion. What is germane to this discussion is this is just a clash of perspectives. There was nothing sinful about Paul's perspective in saying, you know what, I just want to meet the needs as the church has sent us out to meet them. And I'm concerned that we're going to be dragging along the baggage of a weak-hearted guy who isn't suited for it. Let's protect him from another failure, and let's protect the ministry from being dragged down. There's nothing sinful about that perspective. And there's nothing sinful about Barnabas' perspective. Barnabas is thinking, this is a teachable moment. This is an important time. Let's encourage the guy. Man, he could come out of this a better man. This time he says he won't fail. He's ready to go. Let's give him a shot. You might say, well, Barnabas is more patient and compassionate. Paul's less patient and less compassionate. Maybe. It could just be that they have different goals, a different manner of reaching those ministry goals, and at times maybe even a different level of maturity, but clearly they had different perspectives based upon the way they were wired. What did it result in? Verse 39, there occurred such a sharp disagreement that they separated from one another. I don't believe that means that they decided, you know, that the other was a sinner and couldn't be helped. If that were the case, the church leaders would have been involved. If they separated from one another and were still sent out, I believe the church would have seen them as in need of not going and coming back to the church and resolving this matter, because sin would have been involved. How do you send missionaries out on a journey if they're sinning against one another? So obviously the church didn't think that this was a sinful issue. But it was a sharp disagreement, and they separated from one another. Barnabas took Mark. I can just almost hear Paul saying, "All right, fine. Yeah, you'll see where that gets you." And I can almost hear Barnabas saying, "Well, you know what? You're going to miss out on the joy and the privilege. So, you know, well, I just agree to disagree." Okay, we agree to disagree. And they just took it to the church, and the church said, "Yeah, all right, that's fine. You know, well, you guys can't see eye to eye. Barnabas, go. Go with John Mark. Do your ministry." Paul, verse 40, he chose Silas, and they left, and they were committed by the brethren to the grace of the Lord. There you go. Different personalities, different perspectives, different goals, different purposes, different pursuits, maybe even different maturity levels. There's nothing wrong with that, guys. There's nothing wrong with that. If you're going to lead effectively, you're going to have to be big enough to accept that. You got to be big enough to accept that. I don't always like the fact that it causes tension, but I have been privileged to watch how that tension, if responded to properly, matures us as a leadership team. Gives us more confidence in the growth of one another. Helps us understand that we're more submissive than we perhaps thought of each other. More submissive to truth. Maybe we got together in a room and just tried to hammer it out, and through two or three meetings, it just got difficult. And yet we persevered through that difference of opinion. And in the persevering process, we saw a softening of each other's heart toward the principles that were being presented to keep us from sin. And in the end, maybe we didn't agree at all on the way we should go, but it's more okay now that we're different on that than it was before. Why? Because we're more understanding of each other's perspective. We're more humbled by the process. We have proven to one another our love for one another by being willing to go through it. And in the end, the church sees two leaders who are more mature having gone through the tension. I don't like the tension. You know, I personally would just rather eliminate anything that is going to distract us from focused gospel ministry. But as much as I would like peace, I have to make sure that it's not a manufactured peace through compromise. I can't manufacture peace and effective leadership as a team. I need to know that conflict is normal. Differences of opinion, even sharp ones, are normal. And I have to be big enough to accept that. Are you big enough to accept that? Check your heart. Are you a timid person who, when conflict or differences arise in the room and there's tension, the first thing you want to do is run out of the meeting and not come back? If that's you, you're missing out on privilege, the joy of growth, not helping the church. You know what you'll be tempted to do if you do that, run from conflict and a lack of courage? You'll be tempted when a person from the congregation comes to you and says, "Hey, what's going on with this decision?" You'll be tempted to immediately undermine the whole leadership work on that decision, and you'll be complaining about it. "Yeah, I hate conflict. I can't stand the fact that we can't agree. These two guys over here are bullheaded." You've not even worked through the process. You're just filtering the tension through your own comfort zone and running from it. Look, conflict is normal in a leadership team. Are you big enough to handle that? Or are you the kind of person that just wants to silence the conflict by pounding it out? You know, just aggressively calling people sinners just because they disagree sharply. You know, maybe there was a tendency in that sending of these missionaries for someone to say, well, man, Paul's arrogant and Barnabas is, you know, those two guys should just get along. That's a wrong perspective. You can't call somebody out for sin if sin hasn't occurred. A disagreement is not sin. A difference of opinion is worth exploring. A difference of opinion, even a sharp one, brings men together so that iron can sharpen iron. You know, the same is true in marriage. When you go into marriage and you think it's going to be no conflict, or you're hoping that you can maintain your marriage without any conflict, you're making an early blunder, because two people coming together for intimate interaction 24/7, when they come from different backgrounds and they're both sinners, hello, do the math. You're going to rub into serious conflict. I love Dave Harvey's book, When Sinners Say I Do. It's a great book because that's all he says over and over again. Get used to it. In fact, he says, if you're there with your spouse one night talking in bed as you prepare to go to sleep, he said, turn over to them and say, I'm so glad that you're married to me and I'm married to you. Welcome to the world of a sinner. You've married a sinner. Enjoy it. You know, kind of a thing. Well, in a similar sense, leadership teams should be the same way. I mean, we are all sinners. We should stick together. The first sign of conflict doesn't mean there's sin. It may be that it results in that, but it shouldn't cause us to get aggressive and start calling people out. That's another thing that's offensive on a leadership team. And when you have a tense discussion, you know, the faint-hearted guy runs out of the room and doesn't learn from it. The aggressive people want to silence it out and call it all sin. Look, you're just having a serious disagreement over things that are normal differences in the way we look at things. That's okay. If you're not big enough to handle that, get off the leadership team. Because you're not going to preserve unity. You're going to endanger it for your own personal comfort zone. You shouldn't glory in conflict, and you certainly shouldn't escalate it. You should diffuse it by godliness. But conflict that comes from just general differences, man, you should appreciate it. Think through it carefully. Explore it. Learn from it. The common approaches are the defensive posture. You know, I'm just if somebody disagrees with me, I just go on the defensive, try to silence it with a defensive mode. And you don't want to do that. You don't want to be defensive and act like you've got to find blame and place it somewhere and completely deflect and quickly get the attention off of you. Share your perspective. Think it through. Learn from the tension. Or as I said, the aggressive approach, I'm going to silence this, call it out, or I'm going to dominate, just going to by sheer intimidation, dominate everybody, and therefore there's no conflict. I'm the only one in the room that wins. Well, that's not seeking to preserve the unity of the Spirit. Spirit may be doing something to teach all of you together. You can't be the only one talking in the room. If that's your tendency, you got to really work on that. You don't want to be the guy in the room that, because there's tension, you're uncomfortable with it, and so your posture is to be aggressive and silence everybody by being the loudest one in the room, who speaks the most, interrupts, can't be spoken to, doesn't listen. You don't want to be that kind of guy. Far too many times, church leadership that has called me on the phone has been in a situation where there's one elder on the board who believes that he's the only voice that should be heard, and he shouts everybody else down. Don't be that person. That's not a posture to take. Others just try to do nothing, or they just abdicate. You know, they blame shift, abdicate their leadership. They try to do nothing as if the problem's going to go away. That's dangerous. That's very, very dangerous. So what do we do? Well, we remember that conflict is normal. Differences of opinion are normal. If you have that in your hand and you're thankful for that and you're learning from it, you're going to move forward with greater strength. Now, what happens if the conflict is something that escalates into sinfulness? What do we do as leaders when we're trying to solve a difference of opinion that has descended into sinfulness? What do we do when people in the church are stirring up conflict over something and we're called in to help? What kind of principles can we use to help resolve those conflicts and those sins in a manner that pleases Christ? Because that is the goal. And, you know, it's funny. We could talk about church leadership. We could talk about women's ministry, men's ministry. We could talk about youth ministry, student ministry, philosophy of ministry, doctrine. We could talk about the life of the church on every level. And one of our greatest concerns and most common issues is the resolution of conflict in a way that pleases Christ. You're going to spend most of your ministry striving to do that. You won't spend most of your ministry in the study of God's Word and preaching it in some peaceful environment. You're going to spend most of your time, if you study hard and you preach well, and you're going to spend most of your time in shepherding the flock through conflict. Lots of it. So, if it's conflict as a result of sin, what do we do? Well, first of all, we have to realize, and everyone must know, the origin of sinful conflict. The origin of it. Look at James chapter 4, and let's just review for a moment what we already know. In other words, if it's not about just the differences in the way people look at life, but sin has entered the disagreement, if that's the case, let's be clear on the origin of all of that. Where sin is involved in conflict, this is applicable to every area of life, but particularly leadership, you know the source of it based upon what the Word of God says. It is unredeemed fleshly appetites. And there's no getting around it. It's simple to grasp, as James puts it forth here in chapter 4, beginning in verse 1. What is the source of quarrels and conflicts among you? By the way, he's talking here not about general conflict over differences, but he's talking about sin here. What's the source of quarrels and conflicts in the sense that they've descended into sin? Sinfulness. How do we know that? Because he's talking about the origination of them, and this is what he says about it. Is not the source your pleasures that wage war in your members? And I'm not really sure, again, sometimes of the clarity of the translation. When it says in your members, he's not necessarily talking about the fact that you take your body and you go sin with it. The whole phrase means that you have appetites that do result in attitudinal sin and outward sins against people. It may involve the sin of your body, either immorally or factiously. It may involve something as desperate as murder, which he mentions in verse 2. But primarily when he says these pleasures wage war in your members, he is speaking about it in the similar way that Paul does in Romans 6. Do not continue to present your members as slaves to unrighteousness. What does he mean? Your appetites, which result in outward sin. Don't keep doing that. Don't present your mind and your heart and your affections as in bondage to sin and have it result in outward sins. So here, James is telling us that the source of all sinful conflict is your own pleasure waging war against all that you know of the truth. And it's waging war in your appetites and how that works itself out in the sin of your body. And then he describes it, verse 2. I mean, this is so blunt. You crave things. That's epithumia. In the Greek, you lust. It's just a general word for a strong craving. You want it, and you don't have it. So you commit murder. In other words, you go get it by any and every means, even violence. This doesn't mean everyone he's talking to in these diaspora, the scattered professing believers, is a murderer. What it means is you will do anything so far as your flesh is going to carry you right now in your level of wickedness. You'll do anything to have what you crave. And it even will result in hateful thoughts, murderous intentions, and it might even result in actual murder. He doesn't actually specify whether he's talking about real murder here. He's just sort of using it to describe the ends to which you will go to get what you have. And if you want to sort of expand it, he's describing what happens in society. People who murder want something and are angry that they can't have it, so they go get it. It's pretty blunt. It's very simple. Further description, you're envious, you cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. People say to me sometimes in counseling, you know, that person makes me so angry. You know, and I understand provocation, but no, that person isn't the source of your anger. Clearly, you have cravings, and when you cannot obtain something you're envious of, you fight and you quarrel. So the source is your lusts which wage war in your members. In chapter 1, he says each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. So the personal responsibility here is very clear. When a conflict in leadership descends into something sinful, it is because somewhere in that leadership team, if you're not fighting about truth, or even if you start to fight about truth, trust me, if sin enters into the conflict, you're not fighting about truth anymore. It's personal. And so when that happens and there's conflict at the leadership level or in your congregation, here is the plain source. Don't deal with this by making excuses for it. You can't go anywhere. James doesn't leave any wiggle room here. Your cravings are out of control. That's why you're fighting. That's why you're quarreling. Now, I don't know how many times I have stepped in or been asked to step in to a leadership situation and sort of arbitrate and mediate a conflict, and I've had men clearly having sinned with their mouth, clearly having bitterness and anger in their heart, say to me that it's justified based upon the thing that they disagree over. And the thing they disagree over is not a primary issue of truth. And even if it were, I still have to say the same thing to them. Listen, men, you are fighting and quarreling not because someone else has mistreated you or that others just can't see your perspective. You fight and quarrel because you're envious of something. You haven't been able to have it. Maybe you want your perspective at any cost. And so that's your lust. Maybe you want other people to conform to your comfort zone, and that's what you lust, and you're envious for that. Maybe you want someone else not to have so much sway among those who are your favorite sheep or other favorites on the elder board, and so you envy that person's role in their lives. And so because of that, you fight against this individual. You quarrel against them. Maybe it goes back to what we said earlier. You despise the gifts of some men on the elder board, and so you lust and envy those gifts. So what's the best way to satisfy that? If I can't obtain it, you can't have it. So you start fighting and quarreling to undermine them. James leaves no wiggle room here. This is the origin of all sinful conflict. All sinful conflict. So we want to talk about, as a leadership team, some principles that help people in the congregation, and particularly our leadership, resolve conflict in a manner that would please Christ. The reason we come to this origin of conflict first is because if sin has occurred, then before you can resolve conflict, you must come to grips with the fact that sin has occurred and you are the guilty party. So, in other words, the first thing I do if there's a conflict that has resulted in sin, I will spend all the time not on the issue we're disagreeing over, but I'll spend all the first amounts of communication on the issue of the origin of the conflict so that they can come to the place where they resolve that sin. It's no different in my marriage. The issue we're arguing about, if we're arguing with our spouse, is not the issue, really, if sin has occurred. I've now elevated the matter to an offense against God, and in offending my spouse by descending into sin, I have an obligation to make that right. And I can't think clearly and objectively if I don't. Psalm 66:18 says, if we regard iniquity in our hearts, the Lord will not hear us. It's just a general, poetic way for Israel to remember that if I'm stubborn and I don't respond to sin that I know I've committed, if I don't make restitution, my worship is substandard, my prayers are hindered, my intimate walk with Christ is hindered. You say, how do I know that? Well, Matthew 24, he says, if you have something against your brother, you know your brother has something against you, you got to leave your worship at the altar and you got to go resolve that as best you can. When you have prayers that you're sending up to the Lord, if you regard iniquity in your heart, the Lord isn't going to respond to those. Even as a husband, if you don't live with your wife in an understanding way, your prayers are going to be hindered, 1 Peter 3:7. So my worship will be hindered, my prayer time will be hindered, my objectivity will be hindered because I am still thinking in a manner that is selfish when God is trying to get me to see my own fault in the matter. I won't be objective. So the first thing I need to do is work toward a confession of that sin. Let's get the sin cleared up. Let's get the offense cleared up. Let's seek forgiveness. Let's acknowledge our fault. I may still disagree on the issue, but I did cross the line. Absolutely. I disagreed on the issue and may have started out even with a good heart, but I stepped over the line because I was selfish. And I don't much care for general confessions that sweep over the matter quickly so we can get back to what we were arguing about. I don't much care for that. If I'm going to help somebody resolve conflict, or if I'm in conflict with a leader and sin has occurred, what I must know is that specificity in the confession is critical to winning back that relationship. It's interesting how Jesus said in Matthew 6, if you don't forgive your brothers, your heavenly Father will not forgive you. Who's he talking to? Well, he just got finished giving the pattern of prayer to those who know God. Those who can say, Our Father. So clearly, he's making the assumption that if you're a Christian, if you know the Father enough to pray to the Father that he would forgive you of your transgressions and restore the intimate walk you have with him when every deck is cleared, then if you hold things against someone else, God himself is going to chasten you without restoring that fellowship. So, several things happen if that sin isn't dealt with when you're trying to resolve conflict. Worship is disrupted, prayer is disrupted, and intimacy with God in my walk with him is disrupted. Now, again, when I say I don't much care for generalities, sometimes when men are arguing about something and you want to resolve that, and so you come in and sin is pointed out, what they want to quickly do is sweep it under the rug with some of those superficial ways that we do so. For example, sometimes we don't actually mention the sin that we committed. We just, in general, say, well, I apologize. Well, I suppose you could mean that you're truly sorry for the offense and truly asking for their pardon of that offense when you say, I apologize. But test yourself. Which is easier to say? I apologize, or will you forgive me for sinning against you this way? I mean, it's an important question. Maybe in your marriage, you've become accustomed to just blithely saying, I apologize, and getting away with it. But you haven't really been clear about what you're confessing. You haven't really been clear about how to make restitution, how to ask for pardon. So it's a lot easier to say, I apologize. Plus the way we say it, I mean, sometimes you can say, I'm sorry, man. You know. What does that inflection indicate? Are you truly sorrowful for having sinned? Or are you sort of casting it on them and saying, man, you made a big deal about this? Or what about when you say, wow, I'm sorry. Whoa. You know, what a surprise that it was that big a deal. I didn't know. I'm ignorant. You're not really confessing sin. It's all in what's going on in your heart. And sometimes our inflection indicates that. I would suggest that you get used to resolving conflict if sin has occurred by confessing it specifically. When we were raising our kids, we used to marvel at how quickly they learned the more general, sweeping ways of apologizing and making something right. But we used to talk about it in language like this. You need to make it right. Well, we wanted to use that language deliberately because making something right means ownership of the sin, confessing it, forsaking it, and even making restitution. Now, that's what it means to make something right. So we used to use that language. And that would mean that if I was going to make it right, I need to confess the sin and ask for pardon. Will you forgive me? You know, I've blown it. I really blew it. I mean, that's what you say to the Lord. Lord, forgive us of our transgressions. That's what you do when you go to restore the intimacy between you and the Lord. Matthew 6's pattern is, forgive us of our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. There's a petitioning of God to restore that intimacy, and it involves language like that. Forgive me for selfishly sinning against you, for having a lust and a craving that I wanted and I didn't care about you enough. Try that in your marriage for a few days when you sin. It's amazing how difficult it is to own up to it like that, but it is also equally amazing the result on the one who has the responsibility and privilege of pardoning you for that sin. So the first thing I do if sin has occurred is I go after that. I don't want to have any discussion about what the conflict itself was unless it's germane to helping them understand how it elevated itself into an idolatry and a sin. Sometimes that means just opening up to James 4 and going for it. Here it is. You guys keep saying that the other person provoked you and therefore that's why you sinned. You keep blaming it on this issue and their perspective is lame over here and you keep blaming it on those things. And none of that is it. The issue is, James 4, you craved something, you didn't get it, and so you fought and you quarreled over it. By the way, James indicates that sometimes these cravings go to such a degree that you can even cover them with spirituality, but the reality is you're not even depending upon God for your circumstances. Notice what he says in verse 2 at the end. You don't have sometimes because you don't ask. In other words, you want something, but you're trying to get it by earthly means. You haven't even gone to God and asked if he wants that for you, let alone petition him to give it in his timing. Sometimes you want something, but you don't have it because you're not dependent upon God filtering it through whether God wants it for your life. And sometimes what you're craving is something you've never taken before the Lord. And it might even be something innocent or good, but he doesn't give it to you because you've never come and asked. You have no willingness to regularly ask God for things. In a conflict in the church, sometimes that's the very issue. Sometimes I'll just say to two guys that are in an argument, hey, have you guys prayed together about this issue? Have you submitted it to God? Have you beseeched God for understanding together? You know what happens in a conflict when two men have to pray suddenly together? It's hard, isn't it? We used to put the kids face to face in chairs. You know, they're right in the middle of the heat of the battle, and I can see that they're not resolving it, and it's become a mudslinging fest, and it is escalating, and they see me come in the door, you know, and everybody's frozen up. Dad's caught us, you know. And so all kinds of sins going back and forth. So they are hot, they are emotional, and there I've stuck them face to face in a couple of chairs. So now you got to resolve it. The only two people in the building, and the building's on fire, you got to put it out together. What are you going to do? Say, well, that seems rather blunt, awkward. What does James say here? It's very blunt and awkward. Sometimes you don't have things because you've never taken them before the Lord. And you're quarreling about them sinfully because your craving is so strong. You want things and you've never submitted it to the Lord together. What would happen if in an escalating difference of opinion, which could result in sin, that we went before the Lord and simply asked Him to keep us from sin in this disagreement? What would happen if we began there? Man, I really disagree with that guy. All right, I'm going to go to him and say, you know, we just did not see eye to eye. Man, we are just colliding in our perspectives. Will you pray with me about this for the Lord to protect us from sin by depending upon Him and what He wants for us in this disagreement? Man, that would prevent, I think, an awful lot of sin. And then James adds one more thing. He says, well, sometimes when you do go to the Lord, He doesn't change anything. He doesn't give you your request. Now, you have a leader you don't agree with, and you start privately praying, Lord, you know, please help the perspective of my friend here, that you would help him truly know that I'm desperately sorry that he's wrong. Look how James puts it. Sometimes you ask and you don't receive because you ask with wrong motives, because you want to spend it on your pleasures. You want the guys to agree with you, and you want unity for your sake, a superficial unity. And so God doesn't grant it. He doesn't change anybody's perspective, doesn't clear up some colliding of viewpoints. No matter how hard you ask for it, you still have a wrong motive inside of you because you want to spend the whole peacemaking venture on your own pleasures, just to apply this to leadership. That's what you want. God knows that. He's not going to give it to you. You haven't really resolved the issue in your own heart of the cravings of your heart yet. So the first place we begin is right here. Conflict resolution where sin has occurred must be a process where objectivity is gained, and you can't be objective if there is unresolved sin between two leaders or between people in a conflict. So don't try to hash out a leadership decision where there has been sharp disagreement if sin has occurred and the sin has been generally swept away or quickly moved over so that with a general apology so you can get back to arguing your point. Don't allow that. Do not go there as a leadership team. Even if it means calling a halt to this meeting and let's go back and just pray together and come back later and we'll make sure we have a heart to resolve this issue. I don't really like to force men. God is the one who sanctifies. I don't want to force grown leaders in the church, men in the church, to resolve it right now in this moment. I mean, their heart may not be there. But what I'm not going to do is pretend that I could work through a leadership issue if those things aren't resolved. Because their perspective is not objective and will only create more trouble.